It was a big challenge. I mean, we mic'd up an old room, like pretty much set it up like a fully fledged recording studio, and we had this very small audience that we advertised the show, and we had a very small audience in there as well. So they were it was kind of in the round. So the band was sort of contained in this little space in the middle, and we treated it like it was a show.
Yeah.
But we broke it up, and we conveyed to the audience, broke it up into sections, and I told the audience, okay, well, we might have to repeat some songs if we don't get them right, and we're basically covering 30 years of music. So.
Yeah, so no pressure, just cover 30 years of music over a few nights. The earlier stuff, the Hunter stuff, is it an interpretation, undertow interpretation, or is it free and easy, just depending on how you're seeing it, or do you stay pretty true to the original?
Oh, it's heavily, heavily interpreted.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of those songs, when the band retired, for want of a better term, I was just doing little acoustic spots in clubs in Melbourne, and the set was peppered with particular songs that people knew, and I would just do them on my own. I just learned how to play them acoustically, and that's sort of state. The band basically came in around those interpretations. So by the time this band got together, I'd so kind of manipulated and changed them, and they just become part of a live acoustic performance. So the Hunter stuff's. It's sort of interesting that I ended up recording them like that as well a long time ago, and then that kind of changed the way I wrote my own songs as well. And so the whole thing's kind of, they've sort of informed me in a strange sort of way.
Did you enjoy that performance with you're the lead singer of a big rock band, a sort of festival band out front, big sound, Hunters and Collectors. Did you enjoy the nuance and the challenge of a smaller venue and playing to that sort of room?
I found those first few years outside of the band Hunters quite difficult, actually. I mean, and I didn't really fully digest that fact until, quite recently. It's only been in the last 2-3 years that I've really kind of, I've just gotten a lot older,
mm-hmm.
and I've just accumulated experience, and I've just sort of realised that, and I go back in and do the odd Hunters show. They do come around, but it's a completely self-contained environment. The Hunters thing is just like it's like being in a big bath, it's just sort of quite detached from the world. And the band's just a lot more direct. It's sort of like, I mean, not to sort of dismiss what Hunters and Collectors does, but this group of four guys, we just play we're an acoustic rock band and we jam. A lot of the songs are just really open-ended, and that's part of the reason why I recorded the album the way I did, because I wanted to just convey this idea that things can just be changed on the spot,
When you're putting a band together without knowing how the Undertow were formed, you've been around for a while and clearly you're good friends and everything else. When you're trialling people, I'm not sure how exactly it works, is there a sense sometimes all that clicks, that works, and sort of straight away that this is a good vibe, we've got a good
pretty
synchronicity?
Much. Yeah, you've got it. It's a turkey shoot. I have no idea. I couldn't tell you. Like, I've played with so many different musicians, and it's just really random. You just meet people, I remember auditioning bass players once. That was the only time I ever went through that formal process, and I just thought it was too weird, and I never really could find. I struggled with bass players, actually, for a long time.
Who doesn't?
And not that I have anything against bass players as such, but when John Favara came along, I suddenly thought, this guy's really listening. Somebody said to me once, it might have been a bass player actually, look, the whole point about playing well is just active listening. It's like having a conversation with someone, and it doesn't happen very often.
Mm.
People talk and then they wait for you to finish and then they start their next bit. And the actual process of directly engaging in the process of the other person's thoughts.
Sure.
It's actually something you have to concentrate on.
Or they're thinking about the next question they're going to ask their very special guest.
That's exactly right.
Who is Mark Seymour and The Undertow. New album out, Roll Back the Stone, 1985 to 2016. Here's a philosophical question for you, Mark, and I'm not really sure where I'm heading with this one. Talking about bands and clicking, energy, when do successful bands, do you think there always has to be a positive energy? Or sometimes can you feed off the negative?
Well, I
if you believe in energy in bands.
Well, I think there has to be energy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the guys I work with, we discuss that a lot, actually. And regardless of the kind of song you're playing, I mean, my material, some of my songs are incredibly sad, you know. I mean, I like eliciting strong emotion regardless of where it's coming from. Otherwise, the music doesn't have any life to it. You
yeah.
know? And that energy, a ballad, you know, a very slow, mournful ballad has to be played with conviction. And the tension and gristle in the way you engage the song is about energy. That's what people relate to immediately. Like if you've got a bunch of people in a room who've paid to come and see you play, they're looking for that X factor and they'll feel it.
A lot of your music has such incredible storytelling behind it, which is what I love about it, and I'm sure that's something that resonates with many people. When you hear, we don't need to list them, but we hear some music that you've been a big part in creating and it's reached that anthemic stage. Is pride the overriding emotion that you feel when you hear it described as an anthem, or do you have other feelings?
Feelings. Feelings are difficult. It's interesting. I don't think you can sit down and try and write anthems. Yeah. I just think it's a real poison chalice. You know, the idea is going, well, I'm going to write an anthem now and then try to do it. It'll kill, just the very thought itself will kill the process. I think songs become anthems just through exposure. People connect with them in a particular way. And, you know, the songs that people think that I've written that, I mean, Grail and Arms probably fall into that category most distinctly. But when you look at Arms, Grail doesn't have a chorus, and Arms is a love song that is very personal. And that's probably that particular song, the trajectory that's gone on is quite unusual, I think, because it's a song built around a chorus. But when you actually look at those two songs as standalone pieces, they're so unlike each other, but they both fall into that category. So, I mean, how you can define an anthem, I don't really know.
Final question, and that is there such a thing as the perfect gig? Does that exist?
Look, I take away all a gig can be fantastic for a whole lot of different reasons, you know. So I don't think there's you can't perfect it.
Yep.
It's impossible. You can't, it's just like songwriting. You can't perfect the process, you know. It's a real, you're just wrestling with feeling. Rooms really define the approach you take to playing. I mean, I find my voice shifts a gear. Like if I'm playing at the Charles Hotel, it's a vastly different experience to playing, say, at the Astor Theatre.
Yeah.
You know, the way I engage the microphone is going to be completely different, just because you can tell the audience are there. They've got a different set of expectations. They can feel the environment around them before you even start the first note. You know, there is an atmosphere in the room, and that's something that is beyond your control. You just have to kind of move into that space and perform, you know, and the outcome. One thing I do find myself doing quite often is just thinking certain songs just might that's what's fantastic about this band. I'll come off stage and I'll go, we'll be riding home in the bus, and I'll say, gee, the way we played such and such, you know, it was like there was something really happened there. That was incredible. I mean, and then someone else might say, and that's a conversation I've been having for decades, you know, and someone else might say, yeah, I love the way that middle eight came out there, and you know, and I shifted up to that F sharp, you know, and I don't know why I did it, it just happened, you know. And that's magic. That's where what makes playing music so exciting, you know.
It's been great having you in here this morning. Very appreciative, Mark. Mark Seymour on The Undertow. The album's called Roll Back the Stone, 24 tracks in total, and you've got one for us this morning, Mark.
We certainly have.
Tears of joy. Tears of joy. I've got it written here on the rundown. Yeah. Lucky I'm paying attention. Yeah. Mark Seymour and The Undertow.
Scattered like paper everywhere, tiny pieces of laughter and despair, and you cry true tears.
you feed it every day. Like a moth to the naked flame, you just can't keep away. You twist the truth and you turn the other cheek. Everybody knows it's just salvation that you seek, and you cry. Oh.